Parshas Tetzaria Metzara deals with the Metzara, someone who has Tzaras. Tzaras is commonly translated as leprosy. Not entirely clear that the disease intended by the Torah is what we consider leprosy or not. But in any event, there are different kinds of Tzaras. Tzaras on the human body, Tzaras on buildings, Tzaras on clothing. But in particular, Tzaras on the human body. So the Torah in the end of Parshas Tetzaria describes what happens when someone has tzaras. It says that al safam yata, he wraps himself around his face. It says kol yemash ar negavo yitma tamehu, through all the days that he has the nega, he has the affliction, he shall be tameh, badad yeshev, he shall be isolated. Michutz l'machane, outside, Chazal explained, outside, not just outside the Beis HaMikdash, outside even the Machane Yisrael, out in the remote area of Moshava. Now, Chazal point out, the commentators point out, this is very unusual. Throughout the laws of Tumah and Tara, virtually everything to do with Tumah and Tara and the Torah has to do with the Beis HaMikdash and Karbanos. There are different levels of Tumah, but almost exclusively, Tumah has to do with the sacrificial service. You can't offer karbanos, you can't go into the temple, you can't eat karbanos, you can't do a lot of things. They almost all have to do with the Beis HaMikdash. This is one of the few exceptions. Not only does the Metzara have to leave the Beis HaMikdash, leave the holy areas, he also has to be Michutz L'machane, outside the camp. Additionally, Badad Yeshev. Chazal say that Badad Yeshev, he shall be alone. That means he can't even be with another Metzara, the same level of Tumah. They have to be kind of solitary confinement. So this is very unusual. What is the rationale? Tumah and Tara, we don't know the rationale. There are a lot of things about Tumah and Tara, but what's going on? What is the issue of Metzara? Why does he have this extreme form of isolation? So the obvious idea that comes to mind is it's a form of quarantine, that a Metzara is a disease. Unlike other types of Tumah, if a person is a Nida, or other types of Tumah, which are halachas, Nida we'll discuss too maybe, but Tzaras is a disease. And it's contagious. Many diseases are contagious. And that's why he has to be isolated. We don't want him to pass along the contagion to other people. So a couple of years ago, I was looking at the Art Girl Chumash, and I saw that they had the following comment on this idea. They write, for hundreds of years, the popular translation of Tzaras has been, quote, leprosy. And it was commonly accepted that prevention of the disease's spread was the reason for the quarantine of a suspected victim of Tzaras. The quarantine is Badad Yeshev and the exclusion from the camp of a confirmed Tzara. Rav Hirsch, they bring, Rav Shamson Rafael Hirsch, demonstrates at length and conclusively that both of these notions are completely erroneous. Very briefly, he shows that the symptoms of Tzaras, as outlined in our Sidra, are far different from those of leprosy. Also, the article is very brief. Rav Hirsch has quite a prolix discussion of this. He goes on for many, many paragraphs, hundreds, thousands of words, arguing at length that many of the halachas of Tzaras, both those that we see from the biblical text itself, as well as those that we know from Torah Shebaal Peh, from Chazal, from Gemaras, from Midrashim, Rav Hirsch argues at length that many halachas are not consistent with epidemiology. If this was simply a quarantine, a lot of things wouldn't make sense. For example, he says that Chazal tell us that a chassan, during his shavuot brachas, we don't quarantine. We give him a break. We wait till the end of shavuot brachas. When they went up to Yerushalayim, he says, for Aliyah L'Regel, they suspended the laws of Tzaras. Rav Hirsch says, epidemiologically speaking, those are exactly the times you want to quarantine somebody, when he's going to have a party and people are going to come from all over. That's exactly when you don't want him to be in contact with other people. So Rav Hirsch goes on and on. He brings numerous examples of halachas that wouldn't make any sense, he argues, from the perspective of epidemiology, from contagion. Therefore, Rav Hirsch argues that these are gzeiros hakasuvs, and that these are halachas, and that they shouldn't be understood from a simple, rationalistic, scientific perspective. I'm not going to get into what Rav Hirsch's symbolism is. I'm not so familiar with his system and understanding of the mitzvahs in general, but it's basically a symbolic, ethical, halachic idea, which has nothing to do with basic ideas of hygiene and disease control. Now, to be fair to Art Scroll is correct. The way their synopsis of Rav Hirsch is entirely correct. This Chumash, for example, excerpts portions of Rav Hirsch, a little bit longer than the Art Scroll section. Rav Hirsch says, translation from the German, obviously, no part of God's law has had to serve so prominently to explode the illusion about the, quote, sanitary purposes of Mosaic legislation as has this chapter. On the face of it, he says, it sounds like it would foster such an illusion that it's about quarantine. It obviously deals with diseases, a disease that appears to be contagious. Those affected must be quarantined. Why should that not be done if not in order to prevent contagion? So Rav Hirsch goes on and says that this can't be true. And again, he goes at length. He says, let us examine these laws in their salient details to see whether there's even a tenuous justification for classing them as sanitary regulations. Rav Hirsch goes on and on, as I said, brings a couple of pages in their excerpt there. Kashas says all kinds of kashas that it doesn't make sense, he says. Rav Hirsch's conclusion, therefore, any interpretation of the laws pertaining to Negayim as sanitary regulations must be categorically dismissed as myth, pure and simple. That's the position of Rav Hirsch. That is the position of Artscroll. Now, Rav Hirsch is certainly entitled to his perspective, and indeed he makes copious and carefully reasoned arguments, which we're not going to get into, but he does make lengthy, detailed, closely reasoned arguments against the idea of Tzaraas, the laws of Tzaraas, as sanitary regulations. However, Artscroll, I really think, is being disingenuous here, because again, while Artscroll's citation of Rav Hirsch is fair, that is what Rav Hirsch says, what Artscroll fails to tell you is that the position they refer to as commonly accepted and popular translation, which they say is absolutely wrong, happens to be, as far as I understand it, the dominant view of the Rishonim and even has its source in a Medrash. Consider just some of the most prominent of the Rishonim who did understand that Tzaraas was again, whether it's leprosy or not, I don't know. Leprosy actually is an interesting history. Leprosy was believed to be incredibly contagious by the ancients. The pendulum then swung. People weren't sure it was so contagious. Today, my understanding is we do believe it is contagious. It is a microbe. There is a microbe that causes leprosy, and it can be passed along, but it's not nearly as horrifically contagious as they once thought. It's a disease. It has to be managed. It has to be treated. It has to be. You should avoid certainly bodily fluids and direct contact, but it's not as contagious as they once thought. In any event, it is clear from a number of major Rishonim, and even a Medrash, as we'll discuss, that they did believe that Tzaraas was a contagious disease, and that a reason, if not the reason, for the unique isolation of the Mitzara was because the disease was contagious. Consider, for example, we find this both in some of the Ashkenazic Rishonim, the Sephardic Rishonim, to the extent that Rav Chaim Palagi, the great Turkish rabbi in the 19th century, argued that this position is completely dominant, and he rejects someone else, not Rav Hirsch, the Ramah actually, who rejects this. We'll discuss that later. Consider Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, one of the great Baalei Tosfos. We've mentioned him in previous lectures. He was a great French-German scholar in medieval Ashkenaz, but he was one of the Baalei Tosfos, but also a kind of very Pashup Shat, stuck to the biblical text very much. He writes in his commentary on the Torah, Budad Yeshev, he shall be isolated by solitary. Why? Shezeh HaCholi Mispashet Al Bnei Adam Harigilim Etzlo. This disease can spread to others who associate with the afflicted person. Ulechein Yeh Budad, that's why he shall be isolated. Shelo Yargil Adam Elav. The people shouldn't go near. Says it again, Michutz L'machne, he shall be outside the camp, outside the settled area of the Jews. Gamzeh. You shouldn't go near people. Because he's sick. Also, the halacha of Tumah also says that, but he clearly says also, and so on. Perhaps the most famous and most prominent of the Rishonim who adopts this view is the Ramban. The Ramban discusses contagion in at least four places in his commentary to the Torah. Now, again, certainly the Rishonim did not understand the germ theory of disease. They didn't have microscopes. They didn't see microbes. They didn't understand pathology as we understood it today. But there was, on the other hand, empirical evidence that diseases were contagious. I'm not an expert on the history of epidemiology, but they clearly understood that certain diseases could be transmitted by contact of one person to another, and they clearly understood that there was evidence to show that avoiding physical contact with someone who had a disease was a very good idea. So the Ramban, in numerous places in his commentary to the Torah, discusses this idea of contagion, except the Ramban's idea of contagion, while it shares certain aspects, certain characteristics with ours, is also a little bit different. He does accept that what he calls hevel, there were vapors, or which, you know, we certainly can understand the breath, that certain things are transmitted by aerosol, by contact of bodily fluids. But he also understood that contagion could occur through sight, through visualization, by looking at somebody, whether the afflicted person looks at you or vice versa, that itself could transmit disease, and even mental contagion, by thinking about something, by thinking something with a problem, that itself could cause the disease to be transmitted. So, for example, one of the places the Ramban talks about this is in the catastrophe of Sodom. So the Malachim took Lot out, Lot and his wife, and they told Lot and his wife, they warned him solemnly, they charged him, do not turn around, do not look behind you. And Lot's wife did turn around, and she became a Netziv Melech, a pillar of salt. Why did that happen? So the Mefarshim struggled to explain what was going on there, what was the reason for this dire warning not to turn around, and what was the what actually happened to the wife of Lot. So the Ramban brings Rashi that it was an idea of Schar V'Onesh, that Lot and his wife didn't really merit to be saved, and it was only the Schutz of Avram, and if they look back, they were somehow illicitly seeing the destruction, which really should have befallen them, so it was some kind of avera. The Ramban says, maybe that's true, he says, the Odbo Indian, another idea is, he says, Hara'os Ba'aver Hadever, looking at the atmosphere, the air of an area affected by plague, uvachol ha'chalei manidbakim, and looking at the environs of any place that has a contagious disease, yazik ma'od bi'adbikim, mere sight can cause it to be contagious, v'cheina machshava behem. Even thinking about it can make it be contagious. That's certainly not a doctrine. You know, we certainly understand that the mind and the body are linked and that there are different psychosomatic effects. You know, the mind does affect the body, but we certainly wouldn't call that contagion necessarily. But anyway, the Ramban says explicitly, V'lachein yisager ha'isha metzara v'yeshev vada. That is why the metzara has to be isolated because of contagion. So again, the Ramban's vectors of contagion might have been a little different from ours. But he clearly says that it is contagious. He says the same thing in several other places. He says that the birds of the Taras and Metzora and Pasha Metzora were sent al Pnei Asad. They were sent far away. Malkum Asher Ein Shem Yishuv. They were disposed of in an isolated place. Shlotid Bakatzarat. We don't want any contagion from the Tzaras. Says again. The Metzora is Badad Yeshev Michutz L'Machne Moshavo. Other tumors just have to go away from the Machne Shechina. Kihizki, or Machne Leviyah, Kihizki bro Yeshiva Shloyelet Klal, he shouldn't associate with other human beings at all. Kirecho V'Havlo Mazikim, his vapors, his air, his breath, all these things can cause harm. That is the Ramban's, again, repeated position. And the Ramban is followed by other major Rishon, Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya, another Rishon, follows the Ramban in many ways. Also a Kabbalist like the Ramban. And he also adopts this view that Tzaraas is contagious. He says something very interesting. He says, Parshas Korach. In Parshas Korach, it says that when Hashem said he's going to destroy Korach's rebellion, the men of Korach and Korach's team, so he told Moshe, he told the rest of the Jews, he badlu mitoch eida hara hazos. Separate yourself, move yourself away from them. The question is, Hashem is killing people. Why can he just kill the bad guys and leave the good guys untouched? So he has a few ideas. One of his ideas is contagion, he says. Eventually, Korach was swallowed, but at one point it was going to be a magefa. Later in the parasha, we find a magefa, so he says, Hibadl means you have to avoid physical proximity from the magefa. He brings Lot, the same idea. But he explicitly says this, here he's talking about other parashas, but elsewhere he explicitly says this regarding Tzaraas also, that Tzaraas is an issue of contagion. And we find the Sefer Mincha Blula, one of the early Achronim, he says, makes another point. So far we've seen Badad Yeshev, the isolation, the solitary confinement, Michutz L'machane, outside the settled area. A third pasuk, Al-Safamyata. Al-Safamyata means he wraps himself, he covers his face. So one reason he gives, kind of the conventional reason, is because Tzaraas comes for Lashon Hara, and we want him kind of to wrap his face, to show him you need to be quiet for a little bit, you need to be more careful what you say. Shlo Yidaber Od Lashon Hara. Also he says, Shlo Yitame Acherim Behevel Piv. It's kind of a breath mask, a face mask. Whether it met the standards that we have today, I don't know, but somehow better than nothing, I guess. Cover your mouth. They still tell you when you sneeze, if you're sick, cover your mouth when you cough, when you sneeze, and do this permanently. Wear this thing around your face. Shlo yitame acherim behevel piv. And so too, it says tame tame. They would announce, they would proclaim in front of a metzora that he's tame. That was so people should stay away from him. People should avoid contact, which again could be for lashon hara reasons, as a, or a punishment. It could also be because to avoid contagion. So again, there are a bunch of rishonim and achronim who take for granted that tzaraas is contagious, and that is at least one of the reasons for the Torah's special prescriptions of isolation. And the truth is, it actually seems to be a medrash. In Vayikra Rabbah, the Gemara brings traditions, the medrash brings traditions for a bunch of different amarim of what they would do to avoid a mitzvah. Now we should note, it's difficult sometimes to know in the literature of Chazal, Gemaras, Midrashim, what they mean when they say mitzvah. It seems, Gemaras and Ksuvas, there may be cases where the Gemara used the word mitzvah in a general sense to refer to people with a certain disease that may not necessarily have been biblical tzaraas. We don't always know how the word mitzvah was used. This medrash with referring to tzaraas, we can't necessarily know it was biblical tzaraas. The medrash does end, though, by citing the pasuk of Badad Yeshev. The medrash says, Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, they said you shouldn't go near a mitzvah in a certain direction in Mizra, 4 amas. One of them said 100 amas. It depends whether there's wind blowing. When there's no wind, it's 4 amas, the medrash says. When there is wind, it's even 100 amas. You shouldn't be, I guess, downwind of the mitzvah. You should keep a healthy distance, healthy in several senses. It says someone didn't eat eggs from the alleyway, from the street in which a mitzvah was. He was worried that even food products from that area could be contaminated. So it says some Amorim, Rav Ami or Rav Asi, wouldn't even go into the same street. They wouldn't step foot in the alleyway in which a mitzvah was. It says Reish Lakish, when he saw a mitzvah in his medina, in his country, in his province, he would margim lahon bavnaya, Amrlay, Pokla Astro, get out, go back where you came from. Lotism Varaisa. Don't contaminate, don't pollute our area. And then the Medrash concludes, the Tani Rabchia, Badad Yeshev Levado. The source for all this, the source for this kind of attitude that we keep physically away from Mitzrayim, is the Pasuk in Parashas Tazria of Badad Yeshev Levado, being isolated, not being exposed to anybody else. So the Medrash clearly understands that Badad Yeshev is not just some kind of halacha, it's not just some kind of spiritual halachic sanction. Badad Yeshev is a quarantine for disease. And that we learn all these different aspects of halacha, of distances and food and keeping the mitzvah away. All these are at least one sense, might be multiple senses, ayin panam l'tara, but at least one aspect of Badad Yeshev levado is avoiding contagion, avoiding physical contact, avoiding even contact with the breath or the air of the mitzvah.
Rabbi, we do believe in action at a distance to ayin hara.
Yes, that's a very good point. I'll get to that in a minute. That's an excellent point. So, just I should add, for completeness sake, it is true. It is certainly true. We've probably studied this or heard this as children or as in shmuzin, in sermons in shul. There are certainly statements in Chazal that pretty clearly say that tzaraas is a spiritual punishment, a divine punishment for avera, commonly for lashon hara. So, for example, is the Gemara in Erechim. The Gemara itself asked the question directly. The Gemara says, "Manishtana mitzara shamra tara badad yeshem mechutz lamachne mashavo." Why again? Why does mitzara have this unique rule of isolation? So it says because he spoke lashon hara. Who hivdol ben ish l'ishto ben ish l'reyu? He caused dissension. He caused separation, social separation between man and wife, between man and friend. L'fikach mida k'negan mida, punishment, make him realize the enormity of what he's done. Amra tara badad yeshem. So, difficult to know. So certainly there are other statements of Chazal that say the Lashon Hara, that tzaraas is for Lashon Hara, it's an onesh, other midrashim, and what the various reasons for tzaraas were. Is that a contradiction to all these rishonim say that it's a disease? Not necessarily. Chazal certainly often find spiritual causes. They find tzchar v'onesh, divine justice, reasons for things that also have physical cause and effect, scientific explanations, because in Judaism we often operate on this kind of dual track. On the one hand, we accept that God runs the world, there's divine providence, and that He works things for plans that are known to Him. And we're supposed to sometimes learn more. So on the other hand, that doesn't mean that we don't study medicine, as we've discussed previously. That doesn't mean that we don't also work with Derech HaTeva. So, again, I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of theology, exactly how to reconcile the different statements of Chazal, but while it's certainly true, there are halachas, like Rav Hirsch says, there are certainly some treatments of tzaraas in Chazal and in Rishonim that indicate that it's a question of onesh and of divine providence. There are also statements, as we've seen, I don't mean to focus just on these, I'm just pointing out, it's not really fair to present to the reader that this is just a common, you know, skeptical idea to the Torah that psoriasis disease and its contagion. This is a dominant approach in the Rishonim and on, that psoriasis has an epidemiological facet to it.
Excuse me. We learn that just Sorat is not just because Lashon Hara, it could be for not keeping Shabbat, for other things. It could happen.
Yes, so there are many different Medrashim and Gemarot and statements in the Masorah that talk about why Tzaraas comes. I'm not familiar with them off the top of my head, and I think you're right. I think there are other ones. Lashon Hara is the most famous, but there might be other ones too. And yes, and I'm not denying that. Nevertheless, I'm just saying that there's also an approach that treats Tzaraas as a disease. Now, Adrian mentioned Ayin Hara. So I saw an extremely interesting comment a year or two ago in the commentary to the Torah of Rabbi Yoshua ibn Shu'ib. Yoshua ibn Shu'ib is a 13th century commentator on the Torah. Very interesting commentary. On Parshas Balak, discussing Bilam, Bilam had the power to curse, to cause harm. The Torah at one point, Bilam himself, Nevuah, refers to himself as Sesum Ha'ayin, that something to do with his ayin. Not clear what that means. The Mefarshim give different explanations. So Rabbi Yeshua ibn Shu'ib suggests that Bilam's power was through the ayin hara, the evil eye. Bilam could cause harm through the evil eye, which he explains using language very similar to the Ramban, that people literally eye. It doesn't just mean, doesn't ayin is interpreted very literally. It means that through the power of gaze, through the power of looking at something, a person can actually cause harm. He talks about ideas similar to the Ramban, the idea of contagion of disease or the transmission of harm via gaze. When I was looking into the background of his comments, so it seemed to me that the ancients, many of the ancient Greek thinkers, scientists, philosophers, they had a very different understanding of vision than we do today. We understand vision is a passive sense. The eye is a sensor, to use modern terminology. The eye, the retina, it reacts to light. So the way I see you is light reflects, light is emitted or reflected from you. The light impinges on my retina. My retina is nerves. The nerves are connected to the brain. So sight is perfectly passive. Nothing comes out of my eye. My eye simply receives things from you, light, and the brain processes it and constructs an image in my head. Many of the ancients understood sight in a more active sense, that sight was somehow produced by rays would leave the eye and make contact with objects, and that somehow would give perception, would pull perception back to the brain. Sight was seen as an active sense. Today we have radar, we have submarines, you know, military radar, sonar. So these things often operate in two modes, submarines in particular. There's active sonar and passive sonar. Active sonar is you have a source that emits sound, the pings, it sends out sound. The sound reflects off any objects, other ships, other submarines, and comes back. The danger of active sonar is that it reveals your position too. You're the one shining waves of sight, waves of sound out there. Passive sonar is you just have a receptor with a sensor with no, you're not emitting any sound. You just pick up ambient sound, which is the way our vision works. We actually have some senses of active sight too, not the naked human eye, but we have augmented vision, night vision goggles. Some of them work using infrared light. But in general, basic sight is not an active sense as we understand it today. But definitely many of the ancients, the serious thinkers in the ancient world, many if not most of them believe that sight was an active sense. And it seems that those who believed in this kind of concept, this kind of scientific understanding of Ayin Hara, were working with an active sight understanding of vision, that vision was an active sense, that something comes out of the eye and makes contact, and therefore it wasn't such a big jump to say that the eye beams that are coming out can actually cause harm like they do today. We have it mostly in comic books, but back then it was considered serious science. Bill, take
some of these laws sound related to Tumah. Yeah,
so that these things are spread around if you're under a certain area.
Right. So Phil is pointing out some of the laws of Tumah actually sound a little like contagion, like Tumas Ohel, the idea that if two people are under in the same room or under the same roof, somehow the Tumah can be transmitted. Some of these things do have a certain resemblance. We can find certain similarities between the laws of the scientific laws of contagion and the black laws of Tumah. It's difficult, again, to make them all square. That's where Hirsch's point is, that there's so much that's not consistent. But yes, we can draw certain similarities. I'll just, before returning to the main train of thought here, I'll just mention that Rabbi Yeshua ibn Shu'ib mentions, in addition to a few statements of Chazal, he mentions two other kind of sources or precedents for this kind of damage via sight, this kind of harm that occurs via vision, and ayin hara. One of them is a story about Alexander the Great. He says there is a story that Alexander's men were once besieging a city, and his men, Alexander's besieging soldiers, were mysteriously dropping dead. And he couldn't understand what was happening. I guess they weren't in range of enemy projectiles or anything, so he couldn't understand what was happening. So he asked his wise men. So his wise men said, there is a basilisk, or multiple basilisks, on the walls of the city, and the basilisks kill with their gaze. So what's the solution? So anyone who's either studied Greek mythology or played NetHack knows the solution. The solution is you hold up a mirror, and they kill themselves. And that's what Alexander and his men did, and that's how they were able to destroy the basilisks and conquer the city. And what exactly is a basilisk? So a basilisk is an ancient creature of myth. Some of you may know it from Harry Potter. Some of you may know it from Greek mythology. The basilisk is an ancient creature, some kind of monster, snake-like monster, that can kill via various methods, its sound, its gaze. This story itself of Alexander does not actually go back to, as far as I can tell, classical Greek mythology. It apparently was a popular medieval legend that was circulating about Alexander. And Ibn Shu'ib seems to think that this is a reasonable story, and at least something seriously worth quoting, that there are these monsters that can actually kill people by looking at them. And the way you can vanquish them is using mirrors. The other statement, another precedent he quotes, is he says that the Chacham said, or somebody says, he says there's a saying that says the Ayin Hara can push the camel into the pot and the human into his grave. That sounds better in Hebrew, or actually it probably sounds better in the original Arabic. It turns out this is from the Quran. Not the Quran, this is an Islamic hadith, an Islamic saying. The Rabbi Brunel actually quotes it as a Muslim, as a Quranic or Islamic tradition. Ibn Shu'ib just quotes it as a statement about the power of Ayin Hara. Again, we have plenty of statements of Chazal about the power of Ayin Hara too. You don't need necessarily to turn to Islam for this. But again, he explains Ayin Hara in a kind of quasi-scientific way based on the power of sight to transfer harm from place to place. In any event, so this is what we find in terms of the Rishonim and some of the Achronim about Tsaras. Tsaras is a contagious disease, and that's why isolation is called for. Now, in the Achronim, we find, in a more halachic context, we find discussion of contagion in various halachic contexts. The Achronim make various statements about whether they accepted as a scientific doctrine the laws of contagion of disease and the need to take normal kind of modern epidemiological precautions against catching disease from someone who has someone who's been afflicted. There's a very difficult, very problematic tshuva in the Ramah. The Ramah is a very interesting case. On the one hand, he was an enthusiastic reader of philosophy, of science. On the other hand, you know, the science that he had and the ideas that he had are often very not modern. It can be very difficult sometimes to predict what the Ramah is going to say about a given scientific topic. The Ramah talked about a case that actually was a social mishpat case. It involved a civil dispute between a landlord and a tenant. The landlord wanted the tenant out because he had a contagious disease and he was worried about catching it himself. He lived nearby, apparently. Or he was worried that the apartment itself would become contaminated. So the Ramah rejects this claim out of hand. Ramah says no such claim. The Ramah says he brings a raya from a Gemara. The Gemara says one particular disease the Gemara says should be avoided, should stay away from, like we read earlier, the Medrash Ramatzara. That Gemara seems to identify Mitzara with Balei Rasa, a particularly horrible and dangerous disease. The Rama understands the Gemara to be saying that disease in particular is contagious. All other diseases are not. And the Rama says, that the Raya is, when it comes to the laws of Bikur Chol, of visiting the sick, we don't find any exceptions, any caveats, anything carved out in the halacha of Bikur Chol. We don't find any exceptions made for patients who have contagious diseases. That means, the Rama says, that in general, halacha does not accept contagion as a legitimate notion. The Rama is brought by Samach Rarim, the Knesset Gdola, the great Sfardic authority, says in Hilchos Bikur Cholim, Mitzvahs Bikur Cholim, Ein L'chalek, Bein Choli Magefa, victims of the plague, which was kind of the quintessential archetypal contagious disease, L'cholim Acherim. Zulas, one specific disease, Balei Rasa, and that's the Rama. Knesset Gdola seems to accept this at face value. Many other Achronim say that this is completely untenable. Of course, diseases are contagious. Again, like we mentioned earlier, we know this. Empirical evidence, you can't hide from the what we see is obviously true. Whether they understood the germ theory of disease or not, it was very clear that many diseases were contagious. So we have, for example, another Sfardic Achron, the Shulchan Gavoa. He says that's completely untenable. He says, Misha Meilo, who's going to listen to such a position to risk his life, he says. He says, of course it's contagious. V'chein nog, and he says, that is the custom, he says, in his area. Shalo levakir choli magefa. Ordinary sick visiting does not occur to those who are victims of the plague. Zulas, he says, who takes care of them? Chevras hamiyuchadim lazeh. There are special groups whose job it is to attend to sick people who are contagious. Bebeta kesef, or v'ketzef male. They are compensated very well for their risk. Kuli alapater, ordinary civilians should not be associating with people with contagious diseases. You should note that historically we are told that Rabbi Kiveger, best known as a brilliant Achron, was apparently also Moser Nefesh as a Baal Chesed for the, I think, cholera in his time for one of the terrible contagious diseases. In the year Tufkuf Tzadi Aleph, 1831 or so, there was a terrible cholera epidemic. Rikveger City was one of the hardest hit, and many people were badly ill, were seriously ill from cholera. Rikveger didn't care, he says. He would enter into the places full of disease to help the sick people. The King of Prussia, Frederick III, who heard about Rikveger's heroic devotion to the sick, awarded him a special royal order, or basically a letter of commendation from Frederick William III, recognizing Rikveger's Mesiras Nefesh on behalf of the cholera patients. Now again, it's hard to learn halacha from stories, but there are other stories of Gedolim who exhibited apparently great Mesiras Nefesh to attend to diseases. But on the whole, again, the Shulchan Gavad's position is kind of the mainstream position, that ordinary civilians, untrained, not professional people, shouldn't be risking their lives just to go randomly visiting sick people. It's just too dangerous. The Stechemed says, should you visit people who have deadly contagious diseases? To Machlokas, he says. The Knesset Gdol and the Ramaz say no. Other Achronim say yes. Very difficult to Machriya such a question, he said. Very difficult to Paskin. Now, we plead to Hashem that he should avoid placing us in these situations evermore. Chaim Pelagi, one of the greatest Turkish poskim of the 19th century, most prolific also, Chaim Pelagi had a fascinating shiloh. In his case, there was a doctor, a heroic doctor, Bizman HaMagefa, again, there was some kind of plague. The poskim often use words like magefa and dever. It's difficult usually to know exactly which disease they're referring to. The general impression you have is A, that it was what we would call an epidemic. It was widespread and very serious. And B, that it was likely contagious. But we don't usually know. Even the famous plagues of the medieval period that we have historical documentation on, we often don't know exactly what they were. Even things like the Black Death, historians are theorizing what it probably was, the bubonic plague, the other types of plagues. We obviously can't always tell from the terminology of the ancients what they were talking about, but in any event, Chaim Pelagi was dealing with some kind of magefa, and there was a heroic doctor, again, who was treating patients. Fine. He didn't ask whether he should or he shouldn't. He just did. And he wanted to come to shul and daven. The people in the shul said, whoa, we don't want you coming anywhere near us. We do not allow you into shul. He said, it's my shul too. I'm a member too. What gives you the right to stop me from coming in? I belong here as much as you do. They said, well, you're sick. You might be sick. You might be a carrier. You might be contagious. You know, why do we have to allow you in if you're going to risk all our lives? There was talk about a compromise, that they would put him in like a special, behind a special partition. Maybe that would be good enough. Maybe it wouldn't. So they asked Rav Chaim Palagi, what's the deal with this? Do they have the right to deny him entry to shul, or does he have the right to say, it's my right to come to shul? So Rav Chaim Palagi wrote a long tshuva in which the core of the tshuva is about how does halacha look at contagion and disease. And he argues emphatically that halacha does accept the notion that diseases are contagious. He starts by saying, halachically, the rule certainly is that even if you're a member of the shul, you have no right to cause harm to other people. You have no right to engage in behavior which puts other people at serious risk. So the question then is, does halacha accept the notion of disease contagion as a genuine risk? And the answer is absolutely yes. And he brings a number of sources, including the sources that we brought about Saras. Those are some of his most compelling proofs. He says that the Rishonim did consider even Saras, other diseases, certainly to be in general contagious. He brings the Ramah that and the Knesset Gedolah and says that's absolutely not. He says they're wrong. The Ramah and the Knesset Gedolah who claim that disease that halacha doesn't recognize contagion are not correct. He brings the Ramban about Lot, who says that certainly there is contagion. About Lot, he brings the Reina Bachia, he brings other rayas. He says they're absolutely wrong. The Achronim who said there's no such thing as contagion are absolutely wrong. The Ramah, he says absolutely halacha does recognize contagion as a real thing. And therefore, certainly, he says the community is within his rights to tell him that he can't enter the shul. If this partition, as per medical advice, is a sufficient safeguard, then do that. If that doesn't work, then he has no right to come to shul. He says certainly one should avoid plague areas. Barech, you should be barech from dever. A person who does not, the enum is nag minag ha kantamon, contamination. Someone who doesn't follow the regime of contamination and contagion is a. He says someone who's not concerned, he should visit the sick and take care of them. It's about ordinary people who are avoiding sickness, certainly should avoid contact with other people, and therefore the community is within their rights in denying the doctor entry to the shul. Now, another perspective on all this, which Rav Chaim Palagi brings, we have a number of tshuvas in the late Rishonim, 14th century, 15th century, discussing the theological/epidemiological question, if there is a plague in the city, should one flee? And the Maril, the great father of Menhagei Ashkenaz, someone asked him apparently that maybe that, we discussed this once or twice in the past, someone asked him, isn't that theologically pointless? If your day has come, if God wants you dead, what's the point of fleeing? So the Maril, in a fascinating, very provocative statement, the Maril says, no, the system is not perfect. Sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes the orders are misinterpreted. He brings a Gemara. Sometimes things just go wrong and people die even though they're not supposed to. He says, brings a Gemara to that effect. Malcolm Avis's agent got mixed up and killed the wrong person. He brings another Gemara, even other ayahs to this. He says that, V'chein re'isi gedolim shehol chul makam acher. The Maril says that I myself have seen people who have King Gedolim who have fled in the time of plague. In a tshuva of the Rashbash, major tshuva on theology and divine providence and fleeing the plague, he says, yes, absolutely, we flee the plague. He quotes from the Ran. He says the Ran fled plague-infested cities no fewer than two times. He laid more than once, he had to flee the plague. And this is actually brought in Shulchan Aruch in Yeridea, The Ramah brings the Maril as saying that when there is a plague in the city, a person should flee, should not remain in the city, should not be samech al hanes. It is wrong to say it's not going to affect me. And again, Rav Chaim Palagi brings these sources as rayas also that halacha, in terms of what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to think, what you're supposed to do, halacha does recognize contagion as an authentic, genuine phenomenon. And with all the halakhic consequences that follow, that because of the ordinary rules of avoiding danger to yourself and avoiding dangers to others, a person definitely should avoid contact with plague environs, plague infected people, and a person should not associate with those with the plague wherever possible. So the question, of course, is what about medical professional? We mentioned earlier the Shulchan Gavoa. Shulchan Gavoa says ordinary civilians shouldn't be visiting plague carriers, but there were people who were paid to do so, and they were well compensated for their risk, and they were the ones who took care of the plague patients. As a matter of fact, we do find an early tshuva from the, not a tshuva exactly, there's a sefer, Chesed Lavram. There are a number of Sfarim with that name, but there's a sefer, Chesed Lavram, by an early Kabbalist, Rabbi Avram Azulai. So he also discusses this question of whether people should flee plague cities. And he starts by saying it makes sense. It seems that a person should. He was worried that maybe you should stay where you are for a couple of reasons. First of all, he says, if everyone leaves, if all the sick people are left here, and everyone abandons them and runs away, he says, that's really things are going to get out of hand. People will just be sitting there sick in bed, chas v'shalom, ein darish asam. He says no one's going to bury them, the bodies will be left to rot. That's really not a good way of containing a disease, to allow all the sick people to just abandon them and run. That's certainly not a good way to run society. So certainly, he says, there's a problem that someone has to sit there and take care of them.
So the question came up, one of the doctors went to the rabbi and said, I am going to Africa to take care of Ebola. I'm getting paid. Should I go? And the rabbi said, yeah, you're getting paid. You have to go. You have to take care of these people.
Yes. So the point Moshe is making, that the doctor, certainly the doctor who's getting paid, should take care even of very sick, very contagious, very scary disease patients, is a position that is adopted by a number of contemporary poskim.
So if they're not getting paid, they shouldn't go?
So, right, we'll discuss that in a minute. So the Tzitz Eliezer probably has the most robust discussion of doctors treating patients. He says they should and they must. It's their job and they should. He offers numerous, about a half dozen or more, different reasons why they should. Most of the reasons are independent of getting paid. He does have one or two arguments that particularly apply if they're getting paid. There is a famous doctrine in Halacha. We touched on it once or twice in the past. There's a famous doctrine. The Torah says, Ve'elav hu nosei es nafsho. A worker, it is crucial to pay him on time. It's imperative to pay him on time. Because Ve'elav hu nosei es nafsho. Chazal say, the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, he risks his life. A worker climbs a tree, gets up on a scaffold to do construction work. He risks his life, so you better make sure that he gets that money on time. So the Nodi Yehuda, in the context of hunting, and many other achronim, Ramosha in the context of professional athletics, Ramosha Feinstein, many achronim espouse a doctrine that a certain level of risk, maybe not 50% risk, but a certain level of risk, which would ordinarily still be considered too much for no reason, if you're doing it to make a living, you have a special dispensation. We even have tshuvas from Rav Kook and from the Shem Aryeh, Rav Aryeh Balachover, who say that just simple touring in dangerous areas, they say, I guess like climbing Mount Everest or something, they say should not be done for recreational reasons. A person should not risk his life for fun. If that's your job, okay. So he says, we find you bench gomel when you take a sea voyage. So that's...
apply to elective surgeries?
Yeah, and that might apply to certain surgeries too. It depends, again, what kind of surgery, but in theory it could apply to certain surgeries too. There were achronim who raised issues against certain types of cosmetic surgery on the grounds, if it's really not necessary, and every surgery carries some risk, you shouldn't be doing it. So again, the devil's in the details. The question is how much risk. Everything we do has some risk. You take a car ride to visit your in-laws, so you know, there are tens of thousands of automobile fatalities every year. So it's very difficult to quantify levels of risk, but there is a doctrine in halacha that a certain level of risk, which would be prohibited for mere recreational reasons, is considered permitted for parnasa. That's why the halacha is we bench gomel when we take a sea voyage. But today maybe it's not so dangerous, and time of chazal it was considered dangerous. And still people did it. So some achronim say the justification for taking a sea voyage is for parnasa. You shouldn't be taking a cruise, at least in those days where the ships were somewhat dangerous. You shouldn't be doing it just for fun, but for a job you can do it. So one of the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenberg's justifications for doctors and nurses, medical professionals of all types, risking their lives to treat patients is because they're getting paid for it. But he has many other arguments that argue for it being mutter, even independent of getting paid. So lahalacha, I think he argues that it is mutter even without that. He talks about the idea of the mitzvah, of shlucha mitzvah and nizakin. So that, of course, depends on depends on how great the mitzvah is and how great the danger is. We do have a klal that makom the shchicha zeka, if the danger is imminent, clear, and present, we don't rely on shluchim mitzvah. So that reason itself, I'm not sure how much water it would hold. He brings the Rama. He brings numerous different arguments for or against the idea that the doctor should treat patients. One of his arguments, which I always had somewhat,
Who are you talking about now? Who's the he?
Sicilius. Has numerous arguments in favor of doing it. One of his arguments is that he brings, similar to what we said before about a job, but he says, Gidra Shalolam and Hagu. He says, this is also an idea you find in the Achronim. Things which are considered normal, we have the idea of Shomer Psalm Hashem, certain types of risk are just considered acceptable, are considered normal. Society needs it, he says, if nobody took care of the sick patients, chaos would result, and Andar Lamusia, he calls it, there would be a terrible, the sick people would be impossible, the healthy people, the morale would plummet if there's no medical treatment going on. So he says, it's Minhag Shalolam. He says, and that it has to be that way. It is a kind of a common sense far that the world has to run in ways that make sense. One of the precedents he brings for this is fascinating, I don't want to overuse that word, but a tshuva in the Imre Esh. Imre Esh was asked about serving in European armies of the 19th century. And sometimes you were drafted, you had no choice. But there was also, we know from Civil War history, for example, people often used to pay people to serve in their stead. So the question is this a legitimate career for a good Jewish boy? Can he act as a paid soldier, kind of a mercenary for a government, but can he act as a paid soldier? Today we have professional armies where soldiers in general are volunteers in the West. But the question was, it's dangerous. You know, you're risking your life. In wars, people get killed. So he says again, Minhag HaShalolam, war is considered part of the way the world works. That's considered a normal, legitimate thing to do. And soldiers can do it, so soldiers can volunteer to fight in European armies. Sicily Ezer says, doctors certainly, that's certainly considered an honorable and normal and civilized profession. So that itself would be a heter. And so on and so forth. Sicily Ezer has numerous different arguments for why doctors can and should treat patients. We have a briefer discussion by the Shevet Halevi, Rav Osner. Shevet Halevi was also asked, should a doctor should a doctor treat patients who are sick, or should they just run and save themselves? So he says, no, Shevet Halevi says, absolutely, the doctor, it's usur, it's prohibited. And Shevet Halevi does not explain very well why he thinks this is the case, but he does emphatically say, I think kind of what we all feel, common sense, it's a doctor's job. So, you know, maybe we won't hold him guilty if he's scared, but certainly we think of it as a noble and admirable thing to do, and that's what Rav Osner thinks too. He says, Osir Lerofim, who can help sick people to shirk their duty, Losalek Mitafkidam, they should take whatever precautions are possible. They should wear masks, whatever they can do. But after doing whatever they can, they said certainly they have to do whatever they can not to abandon the sick patients. As one precedent, he brings a story we mentioned earlier of Rick Veger and the cholera. You see, Rick Veger felt it was his job to take, he wasn't a professional doctor, but he felt as the Rav, I guess, as the leader, he felt it was his job to take care of the sick people. He says he doesn't explain the logic, the lumdus of why this is true, but he also takes for granted that you have to do this. Sicily Ezer additionally says if you're going to lose your license, if you're going to lose your career, if you don't do it, that's an additional answer. So again, I guess that depends on the case. That might apply if you simply tell your boss in the hospital, I refuse to treat any patients with this disease. You might not get so far. On the other hand, if you're volunteering to go out to Africa to treat Ebola patients, that probably is your choice, and you probably won't have your career destroyed by not volunteering to do that. So again, some of these heterodox apply to any doctor in any context. Some of them are more limited to cases where it really is your job. You're the one who they're looking at to do it, and there's no one who can do it besides you. So the svaras are different, but again, the poskim have argument after argument for why you should. Not entirely clear why. Not entirely clear how compelling some of the arguments are, but it does seem that the consensus of the poskim, at least those who have seen discussion in the modern era, are not clear exactly what their heter is.
In the time of the Chumash, could a Kohen refuse to examine somebody who had
Sarah? If the Kohen says, I'm scared, I read the Ramban, that Tzaraas is contagious, I don't want to go near him. So what happens if the Kohen decides to refuse to do his duty? Interesting question.
I mean, especially the second examination after we looked at the first one.
Right. So it's an interesting question. I don't know. I haven't thought about it. But on the one hand, you can say the Torah told you to do it. You can't be smarter than the Torah. On the other hand, if I argue that my immune system is low, I'm particularly susceptible to disease. I have a bad history. It happened to me last time I caught it. So can you say that I don't want to do it, especially if there are other kind who can do it? Interesting question. I haven't seen discussion of that. The Nishmas Avraham, Rabbi Abraham, also says that his Rebbe, Rabbi Yeshua Neubart, the Neubart, the Shmir Shabbos Kelchasi, says, also agreed absolutely that it is the duty of the doctor to treat the sick patients. And he added, Shemisarvu Lutapelbo, if the doctor will refuse to treat the patients who it is his duty to treat, Yavru al Lav Lo Samar al Damriecha, the doctor is violating the prohibition of Lo Samar al Damriecha. The classic case is, you're walking by the river, you see somebody drowning, you can throw him a rope and pull him out. But if you're a doctor and you can treat a sick person, the same law applies. Omnam, he says, if the danger is, again, the devil's in the details, and nobody's giving us quantifiable, concrete examples, but he says, Omnam, if the sikun is gadol v'amiti, if the danger is great and true, then he doesn't have to actually risk his life. But even that, you have the right to do, in return of Bekak, you still have the right to volunteer to do this, even if the risk is great. And the truth is, we should mention, we don't have time to get into the details on this, but there is, in general, a major debate among the poskim outside the medical context. If I see somebody drowning in the river and I can toss him a life preserver, I have to do that. No harm to me. Save his life, you're mechayev to. If the only thing you can do to save him involves some risk to yourself, for example, jumping in. Let's say you are trained, you're a good swimmer, but, you know, the guy's thrashing around, and you may very well die with him if you go in. But if you don't do anything, he's bad, they're going to die. So the way the formalism that Achronim use is, may a person put himself into a suffix sakana, risk his life to save somebody from a vaday sakana, that is a major, major dispute among the Achronim. There are numerous Achronim on both sides of that debate. That's actually how the Sicily Ezer opens his discussion. Is the doctor obligated to undertake some risk? Suffix akana, is he? Some say it's not even mutter, it's asr. Some say you're mechuyev to do it. Some say, like this language, it's not, you're not mechuyev to, but you're allowed to. Major debate, somewhat of an unsettled debate. There's a lot of debate on this recently in regard to organ donation, like a kidney or something, where you, the donor, might undergo some risk, but you're saving somebody's life, vandai. So how do you look at that? Also a major discussion with regard to doctors. Again, the consensus is, certainly if it's your duty, you should be doing it, although the exact rationale is not clear. If you're just volunteering, or if the danger is really great, then the poskim are less clear. There seems to be less of a consensus.